The first shall be of a tale from an orc tribe found on the icy world of Kogir. This desolate planet was almost entirely devoid of life, save for the frosty greenskins, as the harsh seasons would blanket the world beneath a freezing layer of snow, making all conventional forms of travel to be almost impossible. The tribe, after many attempts, had realized that in order to endure the frost, that they would need to batten down the hatches and simply wait out the storm by clinging to life within their tribal grounds, which had fondly been named as the Orcville. For most of the year, the boys would pass the time by setting their neighbors' tents on fire, lobbing half-frozen snotlings out into the frigid wilderness, or simply by settling their many disagreements with a good brawl. But, with that said, due to the curious orbit of their world, for 1 month out of the year, the planet would come close enough to its parental star for the snow layer to melt, revealing the boundless tundras and mountain ranges beneath. As the ice disappeared, the great population of squigs, previously frozen in hibernation, would awaken to bound out, leaping through the landscapes in their search of food. Unfortunately, however, the orcs had quickly realized that this was the prime time for hunting, and so their tribe had named this month as Squigmas, with each and every boy setting out from their camp to capture as many of the plump little squigs as possible. Each orc would return from their hunt with dozens of squigs in tow, some of which would be hung up within their tents, whilst the majority would be stored beneath the earth, thusly assuring that the boys would still have a supply of food when the next long winter came to visit. The presiding war boss, who had named himself as Wargustus, had ordered that at the end of the warm season, that the tribe would come together for a great squig feast, and that once fed, the boys could settle their differences in a mock battle, hopefully sating their appetites for the war, which would surely never come. But in any case, in the months preceding that year's Squigmas, Wargustus had grown irate at the frozen and quite pathetic state of his tribe, and so, in a fit of green rage, he grabbed his personal grot companion and hurled him out of the camp, to be accompanied only by a torrent of indecipherable obscenities. The grot, understanding that he could not return, set out into the icy wastes, ascending the nearby Mount Crump, upon which he stumbled into a shrouded cave, partially covered by an immense snowdrift. Over the following days, he set up his squalid little camp. But looking out from his cavernous new home, he could still spy the distant tribal grounds of Orcville. As more time passed and as the snows began to clear, he couldn't help but feel bitter that he was now destined to miss out on Squigmas for the rest of his short little life. This feeling only grew as the festive season progressed, as the outcast could do little but stare down into the town, his paltry green brow furled into a grotty little frown. He saw the boys hanging up their shooters whilst others cleared the central grounds for the mock battle, but worst of all, he saw the growing pile of squigs soon to be cooked up and devoured amidst the joyous occasion of the Squigmas feast. He knew that in a few days that he'd hear the ear-splitting noise of the boys and their brutal toys clashing with one another after savoring the squigs, roasted, boiled, and braised. With this, the grot had an idea most awful. He knew that if he couldn't enjoy this year's Squigmas, that no one could. And so he made a small, sneaky outfit for his small, sneaky body and awaited for the inevitable fall of night. On a makeshift sleigh of scrap, pulled by a decrepit old squig, he set down from the mountain to sneak into his old home of Orcville. The campgrounds were silent, with the greenskins soundly sleeping, presumably each dreaming of a war which would never come. But as the Grot passed the mech shop, he said to himself, "This is stop number one." Sneaking through the vents, he saw the crude weapons and tools of the Odd Boys, all of which he scooped up and shoved into his great squig-hide sack. Next, he moved to the old storehouses and pried open the ill-kept pantry, stealing the squigs and fungal puddings once intended for the festive feast. As the Grot slunk away, he heard a timid squeal in his wake, and upon turning, he saw a tired little snotling still rubbing its dreams from its eyes. As the little creature opened its mouth to speak, the Grot, not wishing to be caught, simply clobbered the bantam blighter over the head, leaving him to sleep in an empty room filled only with dust and flies. The Grot moved from tent to tent, from shop to shop, and from house to house, stealing away every last knick-knack and gubbin in sight. And only once he had taken the last scrap of loot from his old tribe did he depart, taking the sled back up to his cave atop Mount Crump. As he settled in and sorted through his new collection, he saw the crest of the rising sun and looked back to the town, eager to hear of their inevitable vexation. He hoped that the boys would have resigned themselves to their tents for a lonesome day of isolation, but instead the Grot could clearly see a collective sense of aggravation. The orcs were roaring, belting out their rage at one another, each boy accusing the other of having stolen squigmas from one and all. The war boss, Wargustus, stepped down from his throne and called for some order in his now furious little town. Furrowing his brow, he stated clearly that to figure out who was to blame, that the boys needed to wage a real war, not against a distant adversary, but against themselves. Thus, with a resounding "Wah!", the orcs fell into a mass brawl, each boy clobbering one another with whatever they could find. Some threw balls of snow, whilst others grabbed Gretchen to use as living weapons. But regardless of the carnage, it seemed as though the orcs were actually having fun. The Grot, high in his cave, upon seeing their joy, felt a swelling in his chest and desperately believed that on this day of Squigmas, that the boss would allow him to rejoin their tribe if he promptly returned with their many shooters and choppers. Thus, he scooped up the stolen belongings and set down on his sled, arriving in the midst of the battle, prepared to deliver the boss's own power claw with a wide, grotty smile. The boss and the boys, however, upon seeing the face of this grubby little Grot, felt no sense of compassion, and instead they seized the little blighter and fed him to one of the portly squigs, which would soon be roasted up as the centerpiece to the Squigmas feast. Thus, the boys all got to enjoy their Squigmas tradition of feasting and brawling, and the dastardly little Grot learned a lesson most harsh: that some holidays are not to be stolen away. Our next tale takes us into the dark city of Comorar. For an opulent celebration of wealth and prestige, thrown by a diabolically elegant archon from the cabal of the poisoned tongue. Her own personal spire jutted out from the very core of this labyrinthine realm, yet had stretched so high that it now seemed as though it was poised to cut out into the stars themselves. At its peak, however, was to be her chamber of celebration, where the distant nobles of Comorar would gather to bear witness to the malign deeds and nefarious acts of one another. During one such period of festivity, where the Drukhari were indulging themselves on the succulent memories of their sickening raids upon real space, a mysterious stranger had appeared within their midst. Deftly gliding through the noble crowds, this towering figure, cloaked in a shawl of living skins, embraced the Archon with a great hug, revealing himself to be her true-born relative, advisor, and friend. He was a homunculus, sworn to the service of this Archon of the Poisoned Tongue. And upon this day of celebration, he sought to bring a series of gifts intended to amaze and terrify their captive audience. He first pulled from his cloak a malformed bird, seemed to be made up entirely of beaks, which, when held to the light, let out a deafening screech, much to the delight of the noble guests who crowded around, eager to watch for the dark magics soon to come. The homunculus, as smug as any Drukhari had ever been, let out a single loud clap, at which point three malformed corpses stumbled into the room, one a soldier, one a ballerina, and one a doctor. Looking closer, they appeared to have been made up from dozens of different victims, their body parts stitched together, forming three monstrous abominations, which each seemed to wish only for death. With a pompous nod, the homunculus ordered for them to begin. The ballerina, ragged and wounded, suddenly leapt into the air, though with this jump it was as if she had awoken from an eternal slumber. As she span and twisted, she let out a piercing scream of pain, so loud that it was as if her soul sought to escape from her nightmarish form. Upon hearing the cry, the soldier was similarly spurred into wakefulness, at which point he let out his own scream before firing his crude weapon at the decrepit form of the ballerina. As she fell apart, the doctor was now awoken, and he fell upon the soldier, tearing him apart, only to stitch loose scraps of each other's flesh back onto the crippled corpse of the ballerina, until the three of them now stood as a conjoined amalgamation of bloody tissue and abject pain. The noble crowd arose from their seats with a thunderous applause, joyously savoring the sheer horror and otherworldly agony that they had just witnessed. But this was not to be the end of this night of entertainment. The homunculus stepped forward, and from his old coat of skins, he pulled out a gift to honor his presiding Archon. It was an ancient and beautiful doll, formed of materials long since lost from the days before the Great Fall, and this creation, he claimed, was to be known as a soul cracker. He went on to state that once activated, that the doll would wake into life only to fall upon the enemies of the Archon. It would then rip the souls from out of their body before cracking them open and spitting out a tiny fruit, which upon tasting would grant the Drukhari with the unfettered essence of the pain and anguish felt by her victim in the final moment of their death. Before she could truly consider the torturous implications of her new gift, the party was interrupted by an otherworldly howl. A crimson beast, made of bone and warped flesh, had burst out from the walls of her chamber, screeching and gnashing out as it tore through the assembled ranks of the noble guests. This was a chimera, a creature stolen from a demon world, to be trained and controlled by the beastmasters of Komora. It was truly a fine specimen by Drukhari standards, but this was not the time to consider its health, as from but this briefest of moments, it had already cleaved its way through at least four of the nobles, and was now on a direct course towards the presiding Archon. Without thinking, she activated her new soul cracker, which shimmered into false life, only to jump down, ensnaring the chimera in a small orb of glimmering energy. Suspended in this frozen state, the beast could do little but panic, as the mouth of the tiny soul cracker doll swelled in size, only to envelop and devour the poor creature in but a single bite. As its jaws clamped down, a soft whimper could be heard before it turned back to its Archon master, shrinking back to its old size, at which point it gently spat out a tiny glowing fruit into her outstretched palm. It was only the size of a grape, but as she bit through its delicate skin, she felt a delightful rush of pain course through her body. It was just as her homunculus had claimed, as she felt the condensed and refined agony of her victim channeled directly to the depraved depths of her own soul. A treat to which she would surely never tire of. As she sobered up from her sudden bout of ecstatic misery, she saw before her another Archon, standing meekly, with his head low in resignation. The figure claimed that he was a prince of an ancient family, and that he had brought the Chimera as a gift intended to garner her personal affection. But as he looked up and matched her gaze, he rather spitefully claimed that this fracas could have been avoided if she had paid him the respect which he deserved, and if she hadn't wasted so much time with her decrepit, homunculus companion. She could perhaps forgive the rampage of that beast, for she felt that the excitement brought about from the four noble deaths was worth more than their lives. However, this new insult was something which could not possibly be permitted to stand. Thus, without breaking her cold, stony stare, she activated the soul cracker once more. As it had with the Chimera, the doll trapped the rival Drukhari prince in a glimmering orb before its mouth expanded to an impossible size, biting down and crushing the insolent noble in a single snap. The surrounding crowd, gleefully looking on, licked their lips as the soul cracker spat out the succulent morsel of pain at the feet of the gloating Archon. In one swift motion, she swept up his essence, and with a grin, she tossed the condensed soul of the prince into the crowd. From here, she simply sat back in her chair and reveled in the joy of watching as her guests fell into a murderous rage, tearing one another limb from limb in their frenzied attempts of attaining a gift which she would never again bestow to any but herself. The next story is one which takes place upon the beating heart of the Adeptus Mechanicus, the red planet of Mars. Though the citizens of this world are sworn to worship the teachings of the machine cult, it does not necessarily prohibit them from quietly observing the passing festivities of Sanguinala, so long as it does not detract from their production quotas. One year, on the eve of this auspicious occasion, there was a boy, resting in his familial quarters, who had heard tales of his parents, who told him that for the children who are well behaved upon Mars, that the tech priests may reward them with magnificent gifts and toys. Now, this was but a fable. And in truth, his family simply wished for him to remain steadfast in his teachings so that he may one day work in a factory with a relatively robust standard of safety. Unfortunately, however, the child became captivated with the idea of the Mechanicus bringing him gifts, and so, on this fateful night, he struggled to find the warm embrace of rest. There is never a moment of quiet upon the red planet, but that night, through the constant clanging and churning of the industrial sprawl, he heard a most curious sound. Outside was the faintest hiss of steam and the squeaking of ancient metal. Looking out into the night, he saw through the clouds of rust-colored sands a train standing perfectly still. It was barely visible through the haze, yet sure enough, he could make out the venerable symbols of the Adeptus Mechanicus, illuminated by a warm glow emanating from within. Further, standing by one of the open doors was the towering silhouette of a tech priest. The boy, putting on his oversized work boots, tiptoed out of the communal hab block, and once free from the confines of his home, dashed through the sands until he stood at the feet of this cybernetic lord. The priest was an amalgam of steel and flesh, wrapped in a dark red cloak, from which dozens of mechanical limbs jutted through, each tinkering and working upon the sand-swept hull of the great engine. Looking down at the child, the priest sputtered out a cryptic burst of binary, almost entirely foreign to the boy, before which he stepped aside and beckoned towards the warm and inviting glow of an open door.
"I don't understand. What is this?"
spoke the boy, trembling in anticipation.
"This is the Martian Express. You are requested at the North Pole,"
chanted back the priest, his Gothic crude and broken, likely having seen little use upon this world where binary is the common tongue. As he stepped aboard, he was met by a most wondrous sight. He had never once seen the interior of a train, but before him were rows upon rows of seats, each filled by huddled workers, whispering and muttering to one another in hushed tones, almost as if they were hiding some dark secret from themselves. As he walked through the carriage, some looked at him with shock, but none dared to speak out, save for one, who grabbed his arm and desperately whispered,
"You shouldn't be here. This isn't the place for a child."
The boy, however, simply laughed and reassured the worried passenger.
"No, silly. The tech priest said I'm to go to the North Pole. I'm going to get my presents."
The man sank back into his chair and wept.
"You don't understand. You just have to leave. Get out. Go home."
But before the boy could speak, he noticed the shadow of the tech priest now ushering him down towards an empty seat near the back of the carriage. Upon taking his place, a small servo skull hovered down, dropping off a small ration pack, along with a curious drink, which carried with it a strangely sweet yet earthy aroma. As he drank, he saw that the train was now moving, with the hazy view of his hab block fading into the distance until they were out in the cold, dark wilderness of Mars. Through the windows, he could just about see the flickering lights of foundries dotted through the landscape, but those too were soon to be swallowed up by the thick clouds of oxide sands kicked up from the ceaseless winds of the Badlands. The starless skies, though similarly tinged to a deep rusty shade, were occasionally punctuated by bloated airships transporting the raw resources and Mechanicus personnel between the various forge cities. The train barreled on, chugging away as it greedily devoured its biofuel reserves. It pushed over the arid hills through ancient tunnels first bored by the early colonists of Mars, until eventually it emerged in a region that no living human would ever wish to see.
"Next stop, North Pole,"
came the booming cry of a Lord Hailer above. Upon hearing this, many more upon the train began to cry. But the child was still happily looking out of the window, watching as the distant lights of a Mechanicus complex slowly came into view. The North Pole of Mars, once known as Planum Boreum, was at one point in time encrusted within a colossal ice cap, though due to the terraforming and industrialization projects of the early colonists, they have long since stood bereft of any form of natural water. In the great fissures and canyons, the Mechanicus saw fit to erect a new network of forges, foundries, and factories, many of which will be used synergistically for a rather dark purpose. But the child knew not of the function of this place, as all he could see was of the glittering lights of the northern cityscape, bordered by ancient hulking machines which had never cursed any region but the pole. Through the dust, however, he could see no other tech priests, only dark silhouettes disappearing deeper into the night.
"They gather at the heart of the forge. Disembark and march."
The priest aboard was not speaking to the child, but to all, and with a grim sense of inevitability, the human passengers arose as one and solemnly marched out to the sands below. The immense clouds of dust, carried up by the winds and caught within the harsh storms of the polar region, made this realm truly inhospitable. But it was never intended for a baseline human to live here. As the group stumbled through the dark, the child could not help but notice that he was the only one of his age within the crowd. The others were all fully grown, but strangely, many were grievously wounded, some bearing ancient scars, clearly affecting their movement, whilst others still were amputees, made to hold on to one another as they struggled through the wastes. Eventually, they reached the base of the facility, where a troop of tech priests had amassed, ready to survey the humans who had assembled before them. None could make out their words, for they spoke in rapid bursts of binary. But soon enough, the humans were ordered to separate out into two groups, one to stay and one to go. The child, who was to remain at the facility, watched as the second group marched out into the wasteland, from where their silhouettes slowly faded until there was nothing left but the dust and sand.
"Move to the forge,"
shouted out a priest, his voice as crude and harsh as ever. As they entered, they were shuttled through narrower and narrower corridors, down walkways impossibly designed for safe travel, until they were met with a stagnant room of iron, illuminated only by the flashing sparks of loose cabling. Behind, the tech priest pushed them in, stuffing the group into this dark chamber before the door was sealed and the humans were lost to the forge. There was scarcely enough air to breathe, not that it could matter, for there were so many crammed into that nightmarish room that they could scarcely prevent their own ribs from breaking and cracking inwards. Yet they still screamed. For what else was there to do but protest this accursed fate? The child, lost within the depths of this forge, thought back on his home for what would be the last time. In that oppressive dark, the machinery of the chamber whirred into action, and the lives of all within were brought to a harrowing end. Their bodies were mutilated, their limbs carelessly replaced, their minds severed, and worst of all, their memories were expunged. As the blood, gore, and detritus rose to consume their lower bodies, the vents below opened, draining out the failures and the dead who had collapsed to the chamber floors. As the machinery ceased in its function and retracted back into the walls, scarcely half of the original group were left standing. But they were no longer human. They were servitors. The rusted iron door groaned open, revealing the tech priest, who now chanted in binary to the new slaves of Mars, obediently ordered to march back out into the sands, ready to serve the Mechanicus until they inevitably and invariably expired. But amidst their ranks was one never destined to join them. There, standing clearly, was a child, erroneously transfigured into a cybernetic horror, yet the cultists of Mars truly did not care for their mistake. They knew, however, that his short stature would possibly be missed by the surveillance and inspection systems within the factories, and so they quickly produced an artifact to resolve this issue. One of the priests fashioned a small bell of crude iron and attached it to the frame of the boy, so that as he limped along in mindless servitude, that he would forever ring out, ever to be heard as a distant omen of the foulest of deeds of Mars. Our final tale will once again be told on the eve of Sanguinala, which had captivated the world of Carolinus Prime in its festive swing. All throughout the capital hive city, families were preparing themselves for the coming celebrations by divvying out extra rations for one another, decorating their humble quarters, and by putting the finishing touches on their venerable red badges, pinned to remember the sacrifice of the fallen angel. But upon a high spire, there was one who did not even notice that the festivities had begun. An elderly inquisitor, well, retired inquisitor, once feared across this breadth of the galaxy, was simply lost in his thoughts. He was mulling over an old theory which had become something of a fascination to him in recent months, but his concentration was suddenly cut short by a rapturous knocking at his door. Before he even had a chance to rise from his old chair, he heard a particularly grating voice shouted out from the hall.
Happy Sanguinala to you, Ebenezer. Your package is just outside.
Such insolence, he thought. There was once a time where none would dare to even breathe the name of the astutely perceptive Inquisitor Ebenezer Scrooge. And yet now it seemed as though even petty delivery serfs had forgotten the weighty mantle of the Inquisition. Perhaps he would have to contact his old peers to take care of this problem. But no matter. On tired old bones, he hobbled to the door, swung it open, and there, sure enough, was the object of his desires. He had requested a single book from a distant inquisitorial librarian, and though he was now officially retired from his post, his old colleagues would still indulge him from time to time with curios and trinkets, primarily intended to keep his mind active and his senses sharp. He would never admit this, but in recent years, the lack of action had certainly taken a toll. No longer was he as knowledgeable on the latest developments in occultic demonology, nor was he able to discern the true nature of an object just from a psychic glance, and yet he was still as untrusting and suspicious of humanity as he had ever been. Sitting before the fire, he ran his pale hands over the gnarled leather of this ancient tome, finally ready to sate his undying thirst for secrets most forbidden. But as he cracked open the pages, he was not met by words nor diagrams, but instead it seemed as though he had unleashed an apparition into this world. The flames before him and the dim flickering candles of the room surged outwards, coalescing into a swirling conflagration, and from this inferno walked the image of a man.
Hello, old friend. Did you miss me?
It was not one voice, but many rising to drown out the sounds of the flames as they themselves sputtered out into a spray of cinders, leaving the room to be swallowed into the dark, with only the glowing image of the spectre left before him.
Malium, this has been a long time coming.
The phantom before him had once been an inquisitorial scribe, though in many decades past he had fallen victim to a chaotic ritual in which his soul was stolen from the husk of his body and trapped within the demonic pages of this old book.
Tell me, what news is there from Terra? The bastard lords hardly send their regards this time of year.
Oh, my dearest friend, how can you waste away your thoughts on those misguided fools locked in their gilded cage when your own home is beset upon by the infernal taint of heresy?
His heart skipped a beat.
Malium, this world is pure. I saw fit to that eons ago. I would never have chosen to call this hive as my home if I had not personally expunged it of its apostasy.
The specter curled its lips into a smile, which resembled a vortex of smoke.
Ebenezer, you cannot possibly believe that mankind will ever be free from the temptations of the dark. Come, old friend, let me show you what the others have kept hidden.
The spectre beckoned towards the door, and the two slipped out into the cold night of the hive. They walked, shrouded to all, the former Inquisitor's old psychic powers still potent enough to hide his presence to all but the most discerning of citizens, who were still far too busy with their preparations for Sanguinala to notice an old man bitterly speaking to himself amidst the dark.
"Do you remember that silver-tongued worm, Fezziwig, caught distributing sacrilegious copies of the Imperial Creed?"
spoke Marlium as they arrived by a window through which they peered into a dimly lit warehouse.
"Sacrilege is a strong way of putting it. There was merely a typographic error on one of the pages. I had no reason to sentence him to anything beyond a public lashing."
"Oh? You really believe that, don't you? You caught a man disseminating an altered account of the Emperor's deeds, and yet you still chose to let him go. My, Ebenezer, perhaps the others were right. Perhaps you have lost your touch."
"This proves nothing,"
snarled the Inquisitor.
"None are truly innocent, yet we were fortunate that his guilt was so minor."
"Perhaps then, but what about now? On this eve of Sanguinala, you can never be too sure of what the Scions of Chaos have planned."
This troubled Ebenezer. He hadn't paid much mind to the coming celebrations, but now that he thought on it, Fezziwig could very well exploit the festivities to spread his heresies far and wide.
"You know that I'm right. Come, let me show you another. One which you have willingly ignored, despite your post."
They moved towards the central district of the Hive, a large open promenade, often used for military parades, or to flaunt the opulence of the nobles to any of their visiting guests. All around were workers, setting up decorations great and small, whilst others still were passing out the bright red badges to be worn for the morrow's festivities.
"Why are you showing me this? It happens every year. There is nothing worth gawking at."
"Oh, Ebenezer, you really aren't the man I once knew. Take a look around. Those badges could be tainted, the decorations could be a part of a grand ritual, and without an interrogation, you really cannot say that the hearts and minds of these people are pure."
He wasn't wrong, of course, and it had been several years since the Inquisition had seen fit to screen the local populace for any hints of treachery. But this was foolish. The world was safe. He was sure of it. Yet now there were cracks forming in his trust. Cracks which, if permitted to grow, would only lead to one thing.
"If you do not act, if you let these insolent curs flaunt their heresy before you, then you will have failed this world. You will have failed the Emperor and his people. But worst of all, you will have failed as an Inquisitor."
This stung him. He always wondered as to why his colleagues had been so keen to see him retire. Why hadn't they seen fit to grant him with new cybernetics to replace his broken limbs? Why hadn't they at least kept him in an investigative role?
"Ebenezer, let me show you the sum total of your failings."
With this, the specter lunged forward, diving into the old man's heart, and from within, he conjured an image most dark. The former Inquisitor watched in horror, his vision split in a kaleidoscope of death and destruction. He saw hundreds of chaotic cults rising from the Undercity, plunging this world into a state of total war, sacrificing the innocent to summon forth demons who tore through the streets in an abject frenzy. As the flames grew, the entire planet was to be swallowed up by the infernal powers of the warp, to be granted as a gift to the dark gods who would greedily devour the souls of all who once called this realm as their home.
"The death of this world is inevitable. You have set this fate in motion.
But Ebenezer...
spoke the spectre, snapping him back into reality.
They do not have to die for chaos.
Overwhelmed by the horrifying vision, the former Inquisitor rushed back to his home, his mind dead set on the notion that this planet was irredeemably corrupt, and that from showing mercy, he had permitted his own sins to bloom. From his chambers, he sent out an emergency vox transmission to a nearby inquisitorial fleet, urging them to enter into orbit to cleanse this world, which in his mind was now entirely tainted by chaos. As the clock struck midnight, and as the festivities of Sanguinala erupted across the hive, he sent the final confirmatory passcodes, and Carolinus Prime was sentenced to its fate via an exterminatus. As the skies caught alight, some believed that it was in celebration of this sacred day. But their hopes were to be incinerated under the apocalyptic weight of inquisitorial ordnance. Ebenezer Scrooge, former inquisitor and paranoid fool, had condemned himself and the billions of others who called this place as their home to death. He had not quelled a rebellion. There was no uprising to crush, and instead, his fanatical zealotry, when left unchecked, only served to bring about the needless damnation of this innocent world. With this, my dearest friends, I do believe that we have come to our end. We must remember that these four festive tales are simple stories to be told around a roaring hearth. But regardless of their dark turns, I do hope that you enjoyed the retellings. In any case, though, as I close this chapter, I will once again be forced to take my leave. But as I go, I will wish you all with a warm goodbye.
Hello again. Just at the end of this one, I wanted to give a quick thank you to anyone who's ever watched or interacted or supported the channel to any capacity since I started it. It really does mean a lot to me to know that I've got your support, and I hope that you've enjoyed everything that I've managed to put out. I took a little break for December. I wasn't putting out as many videos, but that's mainly because I needed to take a little break for myself. But I've got a whole list of projects that I want to get ready for next year. I can't wait to get them out and to show you them all. But anyway, with this, I'll wish you all a very Merry Christmas. And once again, thank you all for watching.